Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. The show has been going on for about 4 years, and I'm a longstanding health, food, and environmental journalist. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and life and the well-being of yourself, your community, and all life forms on Earth with what's going on in our world, in our society, in our economics, in the ecology of our global environment. And that's what we do every week on Connect the Dots. We talk to different experts, thought leaders, authors, advocates, and other journalists and writers as well, about what we need to know to really maintain our habitat here on planet Earth and health as we know it on personal, societal, neighborhood, and ecological levels. Sorry we're starting the show a little late for you today, but I'm very thrilled about our guest. It's actually part of this conversation that I'm going to be having today with Randy Hayes, the Executive Director of Foundation Earth, is actually part of several weeks of programming that we're doing on a very exciting event coming up in New York in the coming week that's focused on this. Our last week's guest, Mary Reynolds Thompson, was speaking on this, and Randy will be talking about these larger issues today, as we will for the next 2 weeks, and we'll talk a little bit more about that event during the course of the program. But let me go right in and introduce Randy Hayes to you. He is the Executive Director at Foundation Earth. This is an organization founded to do what he calls the big rethink. I love that term. To help protect the planet's life support systems. This requires, he believes, a new human order, including economic models for deep long-term sustainability, Earth jurisprudence, eco-technology policy, biospheric literacy, and environmental health. And I would add to that a reconceptualization of the media and of how our personal health and food systems fit into that, which I'm sure is also part of his thinking. You know, one of the problems in today's society is that we're going from quarterly bottom line report on Wall Street to quarterly bottom line report. One of the things about Randy Hayes is he's thinking, planning, and organizing people for the next 500 years, so which is really what we need. So honored to have you here today with us, Randy. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Allison, it's great to be on the program.
Tell our listeners what you're about and why we need to look at these problems, not in a fragmented case-by-case little fashion and kind of argue over little points, but on a systemic level and really make plans.
Well, I think it's clear to a lot of your listeners that incrementalism has not gotten the job done over the last, you know, one, two, three, four decades. People like Donella Meadows, as much as four decades ago, were saying about everything that we needed to know to have the great sort of societal U-turn to a more socially just and ecologically sound society. But it hasn't happened. Many things are actually getting worse. So we need the big rethink from the ground up. We need, you know, to look at our political economy, the economic model itself, and make some major changes. I think there's virtually no time left except for big steps in a positive direction.
We have this new book by Naomi Klein called This Changes Everything, which is really about the interface between our environmental crisis and our economic system. And so, in effect, she's describing for a popular audience and, you know, everyone who cares and is interested, the dilemma, and you have been planning the solutions. Can you give us a picture of what some of them might look like?
Sure. From an ecological perspective, the two main things that the economy does really disastrously wrong is it doesn't internalize the pollution externalities. In other words, with the goods and services in the global economy, there are so many adjacent chunks of damage that are done, and that is not part of the economic model to factor that in and to eradicate that from the model. The second main thing that the global economy doesn't do well is that there are no institutions with sufficient power to ratchet economic activity down around carrying capacity limits. That's really what the cap and trade program, if it had been called cap and reduce, it was trying to put a ceiling on the bad activity and then ratchet it down, reduce it over time. But through the kind of convoluted thinking of cap and trade and carbon credits, people have lost sight of the functionality that's needed to correct the global economy. There are a number of things that have to be done with the economic model, but first and foremost, you know, we've got to internalize those pollution externalities into the system, and we've got to address the carrying capacity issues. So a true cost economy is one in which a toxic tomato or a toxic cotton cloth would be more expensive than organic tomatoes to eat or organic cloth to make clothing from, right? We're labeling our food wrong, you know. We're talking about organic food and food. We should be talking about food and toxic food. Organic food is just simply food. That's what it was up until the age of modern chemistry. So, you know, that's just a few pointers around the concept of a true cost economy. If you wanted a simple label on our current economy, it's cheater economics. You know, and the more you cheat the system by polluting the earth and extincting species, the more profitable you are in those quarterly reports that you referenced. We have to go from cheater economics to a true cost economy.
Yeah, I love that, true cost economy. I also want to point out to the many listeners, because there's a lot of health programming on this network, and I came out of a 25-year reporting on health, integrative health, and all this, and food and nutrition, all we can do about health, and started reporting on environment and policy because of exactly what you're talking about. The fact that, you know, one person gets sick, we eat this, we eat that, we're exposed to this and we're exposed to that. It's not regulated, it's not studied, we don't know what the incremental effect is, we don't know what the cumulative effect is. All we know is at the end of the day, one individual times one times one times one has a health problem, and we don't know where it comes from. So the very things that you're talking about, the pollution, are actually landing on living systems, starting, you know, with all of the species that are going extinct and going right on to us, and we are experiencing them and know people who are experiencing them. So this has a big health price tag, and we're not asking why. So I really, really appreciate what you're saying, and I believe it also has to be factored into the healthcare system. And our whole approach in thinking about health has to be congruent with what you're describing. Because right now, it's just like the Wild Wild West. Stuff is put out there. It has all of these impacts, and none of them are accounted for.
Well, modern chemistry is, you know, a different set of technological decisions, and technology policy is not rampant in our society. We're going to be addressing that in the upcoming conference, Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth, in October 25th and 26th at Cooper's Union, because we have got to look at the role of our technology choices, and we've got to develop some policy around that. People refer to climate change as an environmental problem, but it's really the symptoms of a different problem. In the 1700s, when we went from using very little energy and burning a bit of wood to burning a lot of coal and then burning a lot of oil and gas, we made technology policy choices that had disastrous consequences that were unintended. People didn't think in the 1800s that burning oil and gas was going to disrupt the very weather systems of the biosphere, but in fact it has. And so that has got to be a big part of the solution, is looking at the issue of technology.
And that's why this upcoming conference, which for those in the New York area or accessible to it, you know, please do come October 25th and 26th. It's happening at the Cooper Union Great Hall in downtown New York. And you can find out more information at ifg.org/techno-utopia backslash. You know, often what we hear, I see a lot of this kind of thing, is, you know, oh, there's a new opportunity for entrepreneurship. We're going to solve the problem through technological solutions without fixing the whole superstructure that you're talking about. So on the one hand, you have like a lot of, you know, kind of next generation entrepreneurs who, you know, are coming up with different designs or things that they, you know, they hope will help mitigate some small corner of the problem, as opposed to the kind of systemic analysis on going right for the core that you're doing. And there's also, I mean, it has to be said and it has to be asked, because I know our listeners will be thinking of this. How do we get people involved and interested and bring about some form of accountability? Just today, I saw that, you know, they're planning to build an expanded gas pipeline through the town and underneath Indian Point's nuclear power plant in half an hour north of the New York metro area. You know, they don't even have the people, the government agencies, there actually is no government oversight. There's not really a publicly accountable agency overseeing pipelines. It then gets kind of banged over after the fact to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to look at. We have a lot of holes in a lot of our regulatory infrastructures, and I think one of the reasons that people kind of take a step back is they say, well, isn't, on the one hand, people are saying, well, isn't government going to do this and prevent all this kind of bad stuff from happening? The answer might be no, but also they feel, well, if they're not, what can we do about it?
Well, there's so much that, of course, that needs to be done, but primarily we need to stop doing. If they're building an energy pipeline, they're probably solving the problem in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. First, do no harm. There's so much waste and unnecessary energy use in the existing system that, you know, as Amory Lovins and the Rocky Mountain Institute has been pointing out for a couple of decades, you know, the most inexpensive part of the solution is to simply stop wasting all of the things that we waste. And you know, something like, what, 40% of the food grown is wasted before it even gets to the table. You know, that is a lot of energy. Industrial agriculture accounts for a lot of the damage to the biosphere's life support systems, right? And so living that more sort of humble, less wasteful lifestyle of the 7+ billion of us heading towards 9 or 10 billion, you know, is a disastrous scenario. No government regulatory structure is going to be able to keep up with that kind of a nightmare. You know, in terms of global population, we ought to be thinking at leveling off at 8 billion people and then starting to reduce back to towards 3 billion in the humanistic ways as possible, and then at 3 billion reevaluate what the planet can support. So all of these things are a vital part of the solution.
And how do you see this coming about? Is it an educational process with the public, with policymakers, with industry? You know, what are the mechanisms for helping to make a change? Is it your hope that if Foundation Earth educates people further to the opportunities and key choice points for making change, that they will be adopted? Or how do you visualize that component of it, like that actually happening, coming into action?
Well, as your listening audience will clearly recognize, there isn't a sufficient political will these days to right. solve the problems, but that's largely because there isn't the deeper analysis to get to the root of the problem. And so biospheric literacy is a program that Foundation Earth is just developing right now. Some people have heard the phrase ecological literacy, and we've all heard of environmental education, but biospheric literacy is understanding how the world works from that biospheric ecological level. I mean, we're this giant rock hurtling through space, a rather hostile kind of space around us. We have this thin layer of atmosphere that's part of the life support systems of the biosphere. There's a new scientific framework called planetary boundaries that breaks the life support systems of the biosphere into 9 different categories. and calculates a kind of safe operating zone. People need to know that and understand that. So we're looking at a five-star certification, a kind of environmental education approach, where a high school student would have to get to level two, a two-star understanding of biospheric literacy. We would want all of the MBA graduates with business degrees to have at least a three-star, and wouldn't you want your elected officials and the board of directors of any companies to have a four-star understanding if they're going to be in charge of the global economy? These are the kinds of education programs that are necessary, but part of that education is really understanding technology policy. I wanted to read a short quote from Jared Diamond. As your listeners will know, Jared Diamond wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse. He knows something about societies, and he says this quite simply: all of our current environmental problems are unanticipated harmful consequences from our existing technology. Secondly, he says, there is no basis for believing that technology will miraculously stop causing new and unanticipated problems while it's solving the problems that it previously produced. So all this techno-optimism from the young entrepreneurial generation that thinks that technology is going to get us out of the problem had damn well better start thinking about the unanticipated consequences of our technological decisions.
Yeah, hear, hear. That actually goes right to the question I asked earlier, because those are the people, the young generational entrepreneurs, it's probably really scary. They're trying to kind of carve a pathway for themselves, you know, to a viable life in the future, and they're hoping they can save the day through going down that road. There's their primary points for intervention and really developing the kind of bioecological literacy you're speaking about. And he explains clearly why. That's really terrific. You know, it's natural, I guess, in a desperate time like ours, that people will be, as we just, you know, characterized for that group, going off in this direction or that direction or looking at this or looking at that, rather than kind of coming together around this bigger picture systemic thinking. Let's take a step back and have you talk a little bit about systemic thinking. Why we don't have it, why we lack it, what it takes to develop it. Is it something that everyone can kind of begin to develop? What does that look like, and how does that change things?
Well, it's become, you know, a more popular cliche, and that's actually a good thing. You know, well, we need systemic thinking, or we need a systemic approach. But most people don't know where to go after that single sentence.
Right.
And I'd say the very next step is say, well, what is the system that you're trying to fix? Is it the economic system? Is it the political system, the governance system? Is it the transportation or energy system, the food and agricultural system? Look at that. I mean, if society fixes four major systems, we're largely on the way to a sustainable society. And we have to get our energy system, our transportation system, our food and agricultural system, and our general manufacturing of stuff system in sync with nature, and we will stop doing a lot of the damage to the biosphere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Barry Commoter some years ago wrote in a book called Making Peace with the Planet that if we spent $100 billion a year for 10 years systemically on those four systems, we could be largely on the way to a sustainable society. So the solutions are around. The political will, of course, is not yet around. But we could see a major ecological U-turn in the right direction over the course of a decade or two or three. And if we're lucky, buy enough time to stop the out-of-control climate disruption that could send this planet towards the sort of heat scenario of Venus.
Mm-hmm. What is the heat scenario of
Venus? Oh, in the manufacturing system, you know, that's less clear to a lot of people what the solutions are. With energy, we know it's use less energy and don't waste it and shift to renewable. With manufacturing, it's really we need to go to a closed-loop, zero-waste, sustainable production and consumption cycle. It's the circular economy in that mimicking the cycles of nature. So a closed-loop, zero-waste, sustainable production and consumption system with the stuff that we use.
And so, you know, creating a thing where people, but it also seems to me like you have to organize people. I'll here give you an example. I am currently at this moment in an old family home that was originally a summer bungalow. And so with colder weather coming here to the Northeast, I went out, because we haven't had the wherewithal to change to double or triple pane windows and do a whole bunch of other things that I would like us to do to make the house very energy efficient. We went out to get a plastic to put on the windows to at least contain the heat in the house, and do this every winter. So going out there to get the plastic, they're actually selling a box for one window worth of plastic to put on one window, and then another box for another, another for the another, and all of this cardboard is used to create these boxes. And, you know, so you're saving your energy, but meanwhile you're using up trees through these boxes. I'm sure they're not recycled boxes. And this is like a mass company that did this. And I said to the people at the hardware store, no, this is not good. Don't you have a big way of just buying a whole lot of plastic and, you know, cutting it off, and we'll forget this, so we're not wasting all this. So, you know, it's kind of like when we just, the reason I'm telling that story is that we just take it down to, it's a nice thing, pat on the back, that we're putting plastic on the windows. But if we just take it down to consumer choice, I'll find when I go to that hardware store, you know, that this is what's available. So what is like kind of an intermediate step for people to participate, both on educating themselves and on doing stuff that creates a momentum or a request to industry, you know, let's not waste a whole bunch of tree products just to sell me a little piece of plastic for the window.
Yeah, the plastic window, that kind of packaging is just sort of part of the insanity of the dilemma. There is a moderate amount of recycled material in most cardboard, but not all cardboard. And the listeners, some will know, but some won't, that as much as 15 or 18% of the annual emissions of greenhouse gases comes from deforestation. So that is, you know, mostly tropical rainforest, and that's a giant part of the problem. We can't stay under 2 degrees centigrade average temperature rise without saving the rainforest. We've got to get out there and stop all forms of deforestation. Packaging should all be reusable packaging, just like a national bottle bill would have. You know, we'd get rid of this damned throwaway plastic bottles. Right, and that's part of our throwaway society mentality with packaging and delivery of goods and services. So again, in a closed loop, zero waste, sustainable production and consumption system, no packaging would be thrown away. Everything would be reused and kept in a closed loop reuse situation. We can do that with renewable materials, and we certainly must do that with non-renewable materials like metals and minerals. But, you know, aluminum and iron, steel, all of that needs to stay in complete cyclic reuse. And Europe is setting the trend with some of that. You can't open up an auto or sell cars in Europe unless you have a factory that takes back and disassembles and reassembles and reuses the components inside that car. Those are the kinds of steps that that we need to institute here in North America.
And how do you see these policies and changes being instituted? What do you see as the sequence of how this comes about?
Well, common sense, rational thinking and common sense are insufficient tools to get the job done. You know, we've learned that lesson. I'm sorry to say that one of the primary motivating factors for a lot of the change that we're going to need are these extreme weather events that are hitting the planet all over the place. And certainly here in North America, it doesn't discriminate by economic class. when a Category 5 hurricane hits, or a severe drought or flood, as we're seeing right here in the 48 states, creating quite desperate situations for people of all political parties and all economic classes. It's tragic that that has to be a key motivating factor, but in fact, what's going on is the body of the biosphere, the body of Mother Earth, is becoming spastic. That's what an extreme weather event is. These are ecospasms, ecological spasms, and it manifests as a drought in one place, a flood in another place. People aren't experiencing so much global warming as they're experiencing global weirding, right? Mm-hmm. The weather patterns are just weirder and stranger and less predictable. And for farmers, that's of great consequence. Industrial agriculture creates a real fragility in our society, and that's why we need to shift to local bioregional economies, and local food systems are going to be of great import because we've done so much damage to the earth. We're having these ecological spasms. That's why the term resilience is popping up most everywhere on a lot of progressive people's screens. We need resilient communities and resilient society, resilient systems. People are feeling that sort of fragility, but indeed, the continued extreme weather events will motivate and create the context for people to make the changes at a scale commensurate with the problem. Mm-hmm. It's a race against time, and it doesn't look too pretty right now in terms of the outcome, but as David Suzuki likes to say, we're not smart enough to know whether we're out of time or not, or whether the situation is beyond repair. And so we have got to just stay motivated and keep talking about the big set of changes, the big steps in the positive direction that we mm-hmm. need. We know the basics of what they are. We just got to get out there and do them.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you this question because I know that, you started out as a filmmaker very early on, as a communicator. That was kind of your original pathway into all of this. And I am also in the media. And what is the role of the media in all of this, in your view? And is it serving that function? We had a little glitch beginning the radio program today because we're on an independent media outlet, which operates sure. on a shoestring budget, and an engineer had a train delay, kind of thing. So, I'd love to hear your thoughts about how the media fits and and to what degree it's part of the change in thinking or systemic approach that you're discussing.
Yeah, some years ago in Northern California, the Foundation for Deep Ecology had a think tank session mm-hmm. on these kind of root causes. And one of the seven or nine major root causes of our social and ecological crisis has to do with the media. If people think back, we used to refer to it as the free press, and mm-hmm. now we often refer to it as the mass media. Mm-hmm. It has merged with global commerce when giant corporations buy out and take over the media. The role of the media, or the free press, was to really report and be a part of the checks and balances on all of the major sectors of society, the commerce sector, the political governance sector of society, religion, civil society and nonprofit organizations, higher education. Every major sector of society needs a free press to report upon them and keep them accountable. Right, but when it merges into global commerce and becomes mass media instead of free press, then we no longer have those checks and balances. We no longer have that kind of independent accountability mechanism, and that's a major problem. If I had a magic wand, I would start making major changes in the media, but one of them would be to return the fairness doctrine that, of all people, Bill Clinton got rid of when he was president of the United States. And that led to the lack of fairness on radio and TV in particular, which influences mm-hmm. people so much, where you don't have to have objective reporting and those checks and balances and accountability. So we have got to get our policy around media and free press headed in the right direction, so we don't stand much of a chance of educating people about the systemic nature of the problem and hence the solutions.
And what? How do you place the internet within that? Because the internet, there's also a tug of war, and we've had people on the show discussing these things over that. Because if the internet becomes a commercial zone, then it's just a lot of people kind of marketing their niche in order to, you know, get by in this society. And whether their niche is, you know, how to be happy every day, or, you know, only eat, you know, yada yada, whatever it might be. You know, it contributes, I feel, to that fragmentation. And yet we also see that this even self-commodification, you know, everybody has to have a brand, and then they have to sell that and put that forth.
And even the word brand, you know, when environmental groups talk about improving their branding, I think of the poor sizzling flesh on some poor cow's rump, you know, when they take a hot iron and press it in there. That's what branding, that's where the term comes from. It's a rather, you know, sick and sinister approach to things. So it's less about, you know, I try to tell my friends in the social change movement that, you know, don't focus on things like branding. That's the language of the enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, think about what is it that you value at a deep level. And that's the message to get out there. You know, think about what you care about and what you value and what ought to be emulated in our society. Mm-hmm. But all of this talk about branding is slipping into the language of the enemy, and it's a bad sign. But to the extent that we continue to point that out, hopefully people will recognize it and find different terminology for figuring out who they are and how to represent them and get the message out.
Well, it's funny because when I started this radio program, the engineers at the station, who were, you know, people in their 20s, basically I described to them what I wanted to talk about, which was everything and how it's connected, you know, in all of these different spheres. And so they said, well, connect the dots. So they came up with a title, and I was like, oh, good. That's great. At one point, because I also have always connected everything to social action and participation where possible, I've done a lot of advocacy reporting, and I was applying for the job of impact editor at the Huffington Post, and the new, which, you know, of course, is about get active about this, be philanthropic here, yada yada yada. So the new young guy that was like the new shining young executive editor there was looking at my resume, and he goes, what's your niche? You're all over the place.
Yeah, it's almost illegal to be a generalist.
That's right.
I apologize for being a whole systems thinker and a systems thinker.
That's right. You become invisible.
In the age of specialization, you know.
In that other vein. But on the other hand, I think, I really feel that it's a, even though I feel my own level of, and that's why I'm in awe of what you're doing, and the opportunity of this upcoming event, teach-in, to bring so many people together, which we'll talk about again in a minute. But, you know, one of the things that I feel, I'm an imperfect systemic thinker because we're not really trained that way. We're trained in more narrow linear thought. But I feel it's a great privilege because the more one can see bigger pictures and things interconnecting, the more everything makes sense. And there's something deeply satisfying about that. And that's why I really love the work you're doing and the analysis that you're bringing to all of this. And let me just give another plug, because this is an opportunity for anyone in the Northeast, New Yorker, who can travel there or come anywhere from anywhere in the country. Many people are, to the upcoming teach-in, Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth. Randy will be there. There'll also be Vandana Shiva, Big Idol, Helen Caldicott, she's been on the show, as has Bill McKibben, whom we love, Ralph Nader, Wes Jackson, Winona LaDuke, a whole bunch of really terrific people will be there. It's coming up in New York, October 25th and 26th. Please go to ifg.org and find out more. Really very reasonably priced to hear 45 leading scholars, authors, and activists giving a teach-in on the profound impacts environmental, economical, and social of runaway technological expansion. And this is what we've been discussing on today's show with Randy Hayes. What you're going to be speaking at this conference, and this is very key to the work that you're doing at Foundation Earth. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what your current initiatives are so they get a bigger picture of what you're actually doing?
Well, at Foundation Earth, we've just completed a major study looking at mandatory corporate disclosure of ecological impacts, right? And so a lot of corporations right now are doing sustainability reports. They use a system called the Global Reporting Initiative, primarily, the GRI. And when you read a lot of those reports, it is the most greenwashing bullshit you can imagine. I mean, the Exxon sustainability report would read as if there's no problem on planet Earth. Right? And so the kind of self-reporting around environmental damage that's being done by commerce is vastly insufficient, and it's voluntary codes of conduct. One of the things that I learned from starting Rainforest Action Network and running a lot of major campaigns against Burger King and Home Depot and Mitsubishi and Scott Paper Company and Citibank and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and winning more victories than many is that kind of voluntary code of conduct is not sufficient for the great ecological U-turn. So at Foundation Earth, we've drafted a law, essentially, some brilliant work done by a guy named Neil Glaser out of Philadelphia and a small team of people have put together a 90-page report on mandatory disclosure of ecological impacts, including a 16-page kind of draft law that we would want to Congress to pass at some point. We know it's impossible to get much of anything progressive passed through the Congress in the current context, but windows of opportunity will open and close in the future. And now we're ready to jump through that with a major change in the economic model. With mandatory disclosure of ecological impacts, you want to just disclose the data simply, not the greenwashing spin on it, just how much damage you're doing. Imagine a giant industrial agriculture company. All of the nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from the pesticides or from the fertilizers that they apply on the fields runs off into the streams and the rivers. In terms of the watershed of the Mississippi River, all of that massive pollution runs down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico and creates a dead zone in the ocean. There are over 400 dead zones around the world in the ocean from industrial agriculture. Those are the unanticipated consequences. And so we need mandatory disclosure of that to get to a true cost economy. It doesn't solve all the problems to disclose the damage you're doing, but it is absolutely necessary to have that information and have it publicly available. So that's an example at Foundation Earth of the kinds of solutions and some of the stuff that I'll be talking about. Something that we're looking at now would be the unanticipated consequences of technology choices, a national law to set up a way to register technologies, evaluate that, and issue perhaps every 5 years a report on whether any unanticipated consequences from these technologies are emerging. Right, so that we can deal with them early on as opposed to late in the game when it's perhaps too late in the game.
What an amazing thought. You anticipate the problem, you track what's going on, and you make people report on it. Hey, what a revolutionary idea. You know, it's like, I'm sure that a lot of people haven't thought or questioned why that isn't going on all along. All of this sprang up and we thought it must be safe or they wouldn't allow it. But, you know, you're actually putting that down into, you know, the data and you're grounding it actually, rather than in wishful thinking or promises or, you know, trust us or we'll sell you stuff that makes this look good through our advertising. You're saying, let's quantify it. Let's look at it. Let's do so regularly and in an ongoing way. So it isn't up to me as a consumer to say, is it good? I don't know, you know. I think that's brilliant. I think that's really an important piece. I would add that I think quantifying the health impacts of some of these things would help get a lot more people concerned and on board with this whole thing. People for whom the environment and the fact that it's actually our life support system, as you so wisely say, is kind of an abstraction in the greater abstraction of civilized life. It comes home to people often through their health. A lot, and the burden of health costs in the economy and the suffering and discomfort in people's lives from a whole range of exposures that are not being looked at or quantified or measured. Putting my health journalist cap on, I'd love to see an extension of what you're doing into that arena as well, because I think it would also help enlist a lot more people.
Yeah, environmental health is a critical way to engage a whole lot of people in the solutions. And people also need, of course, to understand that there's no healthy human on a sick planet, right? And it's the entire web of life that makes us healthy. A healthy web of life makes for a healthy human, right? And getting that message and that systemic connection across to people is part of the work of Foundation Earth.
I'm very interested in that because, you know, what we're taught and what we've purveyed and what I've purveyed indeed as a kind of self-help pro-health reporter for many years before I kind of woke up environmentally and all is, you know, take this, do that, eat this. You know, what I do as an individual, can protect me in my little castle of isolation of my selfhood here as all of these other systems, the things that supply the air I breathe, the water I drink, the food I eat, are disrupted, and yet there's this fantasy that I can somehow, with the advice of a doctor who will tell me what to do, I can, you know, solve that whole problem just for myself as an individual. I think we've promoted and sold people on that fantasy, and it's time to wake up from it. So I'm really glad that you're doing stuff with that environmental health area too. I think it's majorly important because a lot of the suffering that we're hearing is coming when there's destabilization in regions. The problems with global agriculture will affect what we eat, what we have accessible in our food supply. And the cries of people suffering health problems are also heard right now if we know how to listen to them. Is revealing exactly the systemic problems that you're discussing. So you have all of these initiatives going on, and I just think they're brilliant and terrific, and no doubt you're in dialogue and conversation among the leadership of the environmental movement about all of this as well, so that people, you know, smart people concerned about these problems are talking and planning and finding young analysts and researchers who can help track the things you're talking about. I think that's a cause, a reason for some hope, in this picture. Sometimes people don't want to look at the picture because they feel we've lost immediately. You know, the minute I looked at it, what can I do? And now we're lost. But I think there's a lot of hopefulness inherent in the kind of planning you're doing. And for that, I really thank you. It's wonderful. And I'm feeling happy to know of it personally. It's like really great.
Well, we don't know if there's enough time to make this great ecological U-turn to a more sensible society. But we're going to either accomplish it or go down swinging. You know, there's sort of, like I said, no time except for big steps in a positive direction. We've got to understand the scale of the problem and the timing of the problem, and our solutions have got to be commensurate with the scale of the problem. So that means major changes in society, major changes in the economic model itself. If I had a magic wand, I would ban usury in the sense of making money lending money. That would shake up the global financial system. It's just insidious the way that it perpetuates growth for the sake of growth. Some of your listeners will know the great Edward Abbey quote on economic growth. Growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell, right? Mm. And what we need to have is selective growth where it's good to grow and selective degrowth where we must degrow. A lot of people out there are saying, you know, politicians, of course, feel like they have to champion growth for the sake of growth for jobs and economic development, and or they don't get reelected. They're giving a false message. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the activist community who decries the evils of growth, I think, are also giving an insufficient message. Again, we need selective growth where it's good to grow. Don't we want to grow in terms of organic agriculture? Don't we want to grow in terms of renewable energy? Don't we want the walkability and bicycleability of our urban areas to grow and the mass transit systems to grow? And then don't we want to degrow in terms of the chemical toxification of our body tissues and our human health? Don't we want to degrow in terms of the agricultural pollution runoffs that create dead zones? I would just encourage the listeners to get a little more sophisticated around the economic growth issue. It's all about selective growth and selective degrowth.
I think that's really a terrific and very simple way of looking at this and beginning to look at the mindsets and activities that spring forth from those two directions. And I think that's like a, you know, from a strategic communications approach, I think that's a really great message that people could map, you know, kind of put their minds around and really begin to think about more consciously where they're in terms of it applies all the way from the individual all the way up the level. Where are we looking at it systemically? Where are we looking at it individually? So we're also not feeling like the whole burden of it has to fall upon us as individuals, which is kind of undoable, but we can play a part, and we can through changing our own mindsets around some of this and not kind of going for growth, what's over the next mountain, I will make it, you know, and that's actually part of the same economic model that's created problems. So we've imbibed that very way of thinking as individuals, and I like your growth-degrowth model, and I'm going to borrow it from you and quote you, of course.
Yeah, please, feel free.
You know, as a way
feel
of helping
to.
People
part of my
you know, personalize
in,
it, and also then see into the bigger system where if we all do that, we actually have some access to change.
Yeah, part of the work of Foundation Earth is to kind of clarify the problem and the solution in that simple, straightforward sense. It's like mm-hmm. going from cheater economics to a true cost economy. Mm-hmm. People understand that. They know that there's a big cheat going on. Why is Walmart the most profitable corporation in the United States? It's because they cheat the system more effectively than other people. They squeeze their suppliers to give lower price points, right? And so if it's a company in Vietnam making tennis shoes, their biggest customer is Walmart, and they can't afford to not have that customer. So if Walmart demands a cheaper tennis shoe, then that company in Vietnam or wherever the heck it is around the planet may have to have, you know, kind of a sweatshop, slave labor conditions. It may have to dump its pollution into the adjacent river instead of disposing of it responsibly. That's the kind of externalization and pollution externalization that we are going to combat through a true cost economy.
Mm-hmm. And through the analysis of what the unintentional consequences and a tracking of that, suddenly someone's looking, someone's watching, someone's knowing, and someone's bringing that information forward. So, you know, I think all of those things together, you know, I can really see where they're targeting, you know, all of these needed areas. That's absolutely brilliant. We just have probably a few more minutes. I'm actually not sure how many minutes we have, given we'll probably start hearing the music for the show when the engineer is ready to bump us, because we began a little late. So I just want to once more, you know, plug the ifg.org program that's happening in New York in the next week or so. People can also go to your website, Foundation Earth, which I'm going to pull up the URL for it in just a minute here, and learn more, because actually the reading, it's absolutely fascinating reading there, because I've been delving into it, and I was just awestruck and amazed at what I found. So listeners, you can also go to fdnearth.org. That's fdnearth.org. And there's a lot more information about all of the initiatives that Foundation Earth has underway that we've been discussing on today's show. And it's also one of the other advocacy groups that I've had on a lot on this program is an FDN. It's Food Democracy Now, which is working for GMO labeling. So it's interesting how these acronyms, you know, are interrelated and all of that. We've done a lot on that. We'll be speaking on this. Can you just kind of do, because just a brief recap for listeners as to why they might want to attend the teach-in being done in New York next week by the International Forum on Globalization. Who is this for, and what will people find who go there?
Well, Andy Kimbrell, who started the Center for Food Safety, and mm-hmm. Jerry Mander, who started International Forum on Globalization, have largely pulled together this conference. Mm-hmm. And it's really to point out that we lack technology policy, and that technology, as I mentioned in that Jared Diamond quote, is of great consequence. In fact, the unanticipated consequences of it are the major problems of our era. And so there is no real solution until we get to this level of technology policy and address it head on. So we've assembled some of the best thinkers around the planet on this subject, a very sort of diverse set of people in terms of their background, but all highly knowledgeable about the biosphere and the life support systems and the carrying capacities of the Earth and the connections to many of our particular passions, you know, whether it's food and agriculture or transportation or cyberspace and the digital revolution. Just one example there of an unanticipated consequence. One of your listeners or several of your listeners maybe can look up the latest statistic, but you know, imagine for a moment how much of the electricity use around the world is needed just to handle our computers, the internet, and the server farms. You know, is it 3%? Is it 7%? Or is it 10 or 20%? If it's 10 or 20%, how many nuclear power plants are required to run the internet? You know,
wow.
How many coal-fired power plants are required to run the internet? You know, and with that kind of an electric, if you, anybody who's gone to an airport in the last, you know, 5 years,
right,
sees sort of the younger generation scrambling around for electrical plugs to plug in, you know, the various appliances, it's draining a tremendous amount of electricity. So does that mean in aggregate that the internet is a more of an ecological problem or a more vital part of the solution? Well, each person can answer that for themselves. But those are the kinds of things that we'll be addressing at this conference. It's going to be an exciting 2 days on the 25th and 26th of October, and I'm so looking forward to it.
Yes, me too. I'm going to be there. And for listeners, you know, strongly urged, if it's possible for you to attend, and if not, I'm doing a series of four programs with different speakers from the conference. Last week we had Mary Reynolds Thompson, and that show, which was wonderful, talking about reclaiming the wild soul, and we talked about technology in that program too, and how we reconnect with the soul of Earth in this technological age. That was the theme of that program. Today's show, fantastic show, with Randy Hayes of Foundation Earth. Earth, and that will be available in archives. And listeners, I hope if you enjoyed it, pass it along to friends and so they can hear this too and like us on iTunes. And then in the upcoming weeks, we're hoping to have Jerry Mander and some other guests and Susan Griffin. So we're actually devoting a full month on Connect the Dots to this topic, because this is a systemic look at some major things and how they all interconnect. So I just want to thank you so much for being with us and sharing your wisdom and the incredible work you're doing. It's an honor to have you on the show, and I am just deeply grateful for the brilliance, the systemic thinking, the analysis, the tools, the interventions that Foundation Earth has devised and it will continue devising. And, I hope you'll regard this program also as a forum for any new developments that you have that you want people to know about. We'd love to have you and some of your think tank folks on in future to keep us updated so we can track these important developments. Thank you so much, Randy, for being with me today.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure, and it's refreshing to have this amount of time to really get into the analysis of the problem and some of the components of the real systemic solutions. I think you're doing a real service. This is what the free press is all about. So let's continue to defeat the mass media and turn it back into the free press so it can be the checks and balances on society.
Yes, that's our job. And, we've been knowing it's our job for too long to change now. we had some shows with Bogmi Chesney also talking about this, who's one of the founders of Free Press, and John Nichols. And, I'm very much their student of their view and their work. And I think we need to I'll encourage your organization to help us find some solutions to make that more sustainable and part of what needs to change, too. Thank you again, and thank you, listeners, for being with us today on this edition of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern, we're here with you. Please check out this show and archives, pass it along to friends, and come back next week for another program about the same conversation from a different viewpoint. And have a great week, and be well.